Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're bringing our focus to one of the most exciting and emerging areas of nutrition science, gut health. We all have an understanding of how our genetics and lifestyle choices can determine our health. However, in recent years, much attention has been given to how the foods we eat, activity we do, and lives we lead can alter the bacteria in our gut, which can have a profound effect on both our physical and mental health. To help us explore this topic, I've invited some of the world's top researchers and practitioners in this space to help us better understand how to optimize our gut health. Today, our guest is Laura Tilt. Laura is a registered dietitian specializing in weight management, sports nutrition, digestive health, and the low FODMAP diet with over 10 years' experience in nutrition and well-being. Laura is a regular contributor to publications worldwide and is a highly regarded podcaster running the highly successful The Gut Loving Podcast. She provides consultancy for nutrition brands and companies in the wellness arena and also runs her own firm titled Tilt Nutrition. In this episode, we are going to break down the pillars of what it means to have great gut health and what you can do to ensure you're achieving each of them. This is a great listen, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. So today we're continuing with our divergence into the gut health realm. And today we've got a very special guest joining us all the way from London, England, Laura Tilt from Tilt Nutrition. It is London, isn't it, Laura, that you're coming from?
I'm actually in Bristol now, but I did. I used to live in London. I only moved to Bristol about a year ago. So yeah, it's London's still what I call home because I've lived there for 14 years. So yeah.
Bristol's not too far from London though, is it? Or is my geography completely out?
No, it's not. It's southwest, so it's about an hour and a half on the train. Yeah, same in the car, so it's not too far.
Excellent. Well, Laura, first and foremost, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time. The world's gone through a bit of a crazy time at the moment. We were just talking briefly there and saying how we're both working from home. How have you been holding up and everything?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if, you know, any of your audience sort of has been looking at sort of figures of COVID sort of in different countries, but we've been quite badly hit in the UK. So you know, I think this is our 10th week of lockdown now, and you know, I've been very fortunate. My work hasn't changed and I do have the ability to work from home. Probably my biggest challenge is that I live in a relatively small flat and I don't have a garden, so I've sort of found it quite difficult being indoors so much. But you know, we are now allowed to go out and exercise as much as we like, so yeah, I think it's a strange time. It's a really sad and sort of stressful time for a lot of people. I personally have been, you know, really lucky, not affected, and none of my family or friends have been. And I don't want to say I'm getting used to the sort of new normal of sort of, you know, working from home, but you know, humans are adapt incredibly well, I think. And for the most part, I'm well and managing to sort of, you know, keep my mood and energy levels on an even keel. So that's good.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a funny time, isn't it? And it's I found myself, I live in Brisbane, probably where we're sunny 95% of the year. It's hot, beautiful weather. And I found myself having to take vitamin D tablets because I'm just stuck inside and not going out, at least for the first 4 to 6 weeks. But as you said, it is kind of starting to become the new normal. So everyone is adapting. So if we get back into this now, Laura, you are a very, very, very well-known figure in the gut health world, especially around the UK. You do lots of writing, guest writing. You run your own like consultancy with Tilt Nutrition. First and foremost, what made you want to get into this area? Why did you want to choose to specialize in gut health?
It was quite fortuitous, really. I did a master's in nutrition. It must have been over 10 years ago now, and that was when I moved down to London, and then I decided that I wanted to return to study to become a dietitian, and I qualified as a dietitian in 2012. And it's similar to being a junior doctor in that when you start work as a dietitian, as you'll know, you go into if you go into work in a clinical space anyway, you do sort of rotation, so you try out where you work in lots of different specialties. And I rotated into gastroenterology and was fascinated. I mean, I'm fascinated by the human body anyway, but particularly fascinated in the workings of the gut. And so, you know, if there's a problem with the gut, you know, nothing else works. Health is really affected. And yeah, just basically it was an area that I was really drawn to and felt quite passionate about. And then I was given some clinics, so outpatient clinics where people come in to see you on an outpatient basis. And the clinics were for people with gut conditions, so celiac disease and IBS. And it was then that I realized how many people, how much of the general population was affected by these types of conditions, which weren't necessarily, you know, needing hospital treatment, but were really affecting their daily life. And there was a lot of misinformation. So I would have patients come in and tell me that they'd been told to cut out gluten or stop eating dairy. They'd become quite anxious around food, didn't really know what to do about their symptoms. And essentially, it became just a bit of a personal mission, I guess, to try and learn as much as I could about this area and sort of support my patients. And I was then trained in the FODMAP diet, which was sort of one of the first dietitians, well, say not the first, but kind of one of the first waves of dietitians to be trained in the UK to teach the FODMAP diet, which was quite a big game changer, actually. So you'll know, but for anyone else that's listening, so the FODMAP diet is a type of diet which can help to manage IBS symptoms. So I trained in that, and then my interest in gut health continued. And it was just really lucky from the perspective that suddenly, you know, we've had a lot more research which has been published in terms of the importance of gut health and how it affects health as a whole. And so I've sort of ridden the wave, really, of sort of, it's been fortuitous how I've come to sort of be working in this area that's become very popular. But yeah, it really started from quite organically of just being interested in the workings of the gut.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you just touched on it there, Laura, that your clients used, or your patients used, to come to you with quite a lot of misinformation. And I'm sure you get this question all the time, but what are some of the most common things that these patients come to you and they say that may not be completely true?
So I touched on the gluten point there. So gluten being a protein that's found in wheat, rye, and barley. And from a medical perspective, the only reason to eliminate gluten from the diet is if you have a condition called celiac disease. And this is an autoimmune condition where the body overreacts when you eat gluten and it starts to attack the lining of the small intestine. So for people who've got celiac disease, which is about 1 in 100, complete exclusion of gluten is the only treatment, and it's absolutely necessary. But for everyone else in the general population, there isn't any good scientific evidence to suggest that we need to avoid it. But it is commonly linked to gut problems, which is, I think, an issue with media. There's been quite a lot of media hype around gluten. There's been some books that have been published by some MDs or doctors, which have suggested a link between gluten and gut problems. And for people with IBS, that affects like 1 in 7 people globally, so quite a lot more than celiac disease. Sometimes they can be quite sensitive to eating lots of wheat, and gluten is found in wheat, so there's sort of a crossover or misunderstanding of what the problem is. But it's just become, I guess, you know, in the same way that, you know, detoxing or juicing or, you know, these sort of detox teas became really popular, to say that you were, you know, gluten-free became a bit of a wellness trend. So people were avoiding gluten and thinking it was helping them, or that they needed to do that to improve their gut symptoms. So that's probably quite pervasive, I would say, in clinics. Also, dairy, people think that that's, you know, can kill their microbiome or is problematic for their gut. Another really common myth I hear is that you should poo daily, and if you don't, that's problematic. We can talk about what's normal with bowel movements, but essentially only about a third of the population poo daily. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with your gut if you don't. So yeah, so those are probably some of the sort of more popular ones, or the idea that you would need to detox or fast for good gut health. So yeah, probably some of the more common ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll deep dive into a couple of those ones a bit later on. I do want to just touch on this straight out of the gate and kind of get a definition, because we always hear this and we always get told about the importance of gut health, or eat this to improve your gut health, or do this type of activity, or this is may not be the best for gut health. Can you just first and foremost walk us through what is gut health? Can you give us a definition of what it is?
I wish I could, but there's actually no official definition, which is funny because, as you said, it's a term which has become synonymous with health, and it's become certainly a wellness trend over here. I was actually in Australia for 2 months at the start of the year, and I saw there was a lot of ads, and when I went into the supermarket, there were a lot of products, so things like kefirs and other fermented foods, which had, you know, gut health sort of printed on the labels. There's actually no official definition of gut health. If we look at what health means, the World Health Organization define that as, I think, a complete state of well-being, not just the absence of disease. But I think if we start to think about what gut health means, it's actually a professor in Germany. I can't remember his name. I'll see if I can find the paper. But effectively, he sort of sat down with this question a few years ago and sort of tried to identify several criteria that we could maybe measure gut health by. So normally, I think it's quite helpful to talk through these. So the first criteria is that you can effectively digest and absorb food and drink. And obviously, that's the main function of the gut that we're most familiar with. And obviously, if you've got a problem with absorption in your gut, that will affect how your body functions. And an example of that is obviously celiac disease that we just spoke about. The second criteria is that you poo regularly without pain. And we can talk a bit more about what's normal when it comes to poo habits. The third criteria is that symptoms like bloating and constipation are rare. And it's very normal to have the occasional symptom, but if you've got symptoms on an ongoing basis, that's a sign that your gut isn't happy. The next criteria is that you've got a normal and stable microbiome. And this is actually very tricky to determine, as I'm sure we'll talk about more in the podcast. Firstly, because your microbiome's inside, or your gut microbiome's inside. And secondly, because we're still learning what normal actually means. And then the last two criteria, so one of them is to do with your immune system. So a lot of your immune tissues lie in your gut, and so gut health and immune function are closely related. And then the last one is to do with the relationship between your brain and your gut. So there's a relationship between the two, which we will talk about, but essentially if that becomes sort of hypersensitive, that can sometimes result in gut symptoms.
Can we go through each of those and kind of talk about, just to highlight to the people at home who may not be dietitians like yourself and I, and when we talk about these things, to you and me, it might be very obvious, but just for the listener to kind of break them down and unpackage them a little more, when we talk about, say, effectively digesting something, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So digestion starts off in the mouth, and in your saliva, you've got enzymes which start to break down the carbohydrates in your food. So I'm just going to talk through basic digestion for anybody, probably a helpful place to start. So yeah, digestion starts off in the mouth, and you've got two types of digestion. You've got mechanical digestion, which is, you know, your teeth crunching up or chewing your food into smaller pieces, and then you've got chemical digestion, which is enzymes, and these are specialized proteins which help us to break down food. So digestion starts off in the mouth, and when you swallow, food will move through or down your food pipe and into your stomach, which is essentially a muscular sac, and once food is in your stomach, the stomach acid will get to work on it. Stomach acid helps to break down food, but it also activates digestive enzymes and work as well, and helps to sort of kill off any potential harmful microbes. So your food spends probably somewhere from 2 to 4 hours in your stomach, depending on what you've eaten and the various components of your meal. So some types of nutrients will leave your stomach quicker than others. Liquids tend to leave the stomach much more quickly than solids. And essentially, the food that you've eaten is turned into a soup, if you like. It's called chyme, but effectively, by the time food leaves your stomach, it's a liquid. And so underneath your stomach, you've got your small intestine. There's three different parts of your small intestine. And as this now liquid food moves to your small intestine, the stomach acid is neutralized and the nutrients will be absorbed through the length of your small intestine. And so really your small intestine is where absorption takes place. And this is why, if there are problems with your small intestine, so I spoke about celiac disease, so this is where the lining of the small intestine can be compromised, there's going to be a problem with absorption. But if your small intestine is in good shape or good health, you'll be absorbing food or nutrients as this soup moves through, and then by the time this soup reaches your, or what's left reaches your large intestine, really all the sort of nutrients that you can make use of will have been absorbed, and the role of your large intestine is to reabsorb salts and waters. But you've also got a community of microbes that live in your large intestine, and they actually work on consuming your leftovers, which is primarily fiber and maybe a few other nutrients that sort of escape digestion. In terms of what other problems can go on with digestion and absorption, so some other kind of, I would say, like common issues would be something like lactose intolerance. So this is a condition where somebody doesn't make enough of a particular enzyme which helps to break down the lactose, which is the naturally occurring sugar in milk. So this would mean that the lactose would actually just move through their gut undigested, and it would land in the large intestine. And this can create problems like bloating and loose stools. So yeah, I guess symptoms of potentially having problems with digestion and absorption would be pain, bloating, loose stools, and also in your poo, if your poo is looking pale or greasy or fatty, that's sometimes also a sign of having problems with digestion.
Yeah. So correct me if I'm wrong here, Laura, this is more your area than mine. I'm trying to think of the number, and 9 to 10 meters is jumping in my mind, but I'm not quite sure if that's correct. Is that how long our GI tract is from, say, our mouth to our anus? To 9 to 10 yeah. meters, roughly? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it's a bus, basically.
Yeah. I'm surprised I knew that off the top of my head, to be honest. But and for the guys listening at home, if you think about that, if you rolled out 10 meters or like a bus, that's a long time. And when you talk about this digestion, the food that we put in our mouth has to travel through that GI tract. So that's what we're classing as this digestion. And as you said, at all different stages throughout this GI tract, there's different functions that are going on, and therefore there could be potential problems at each one of those functional sites.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even that we sort of, this is why it's probably important to look at sort of how we eat as well, not just what we eat. So most of us have really busy lives now, and a lot of people that I speak to do eat on the go or eat in front of their laptops or computers. I'm guilty of doing it sometimes as well. And obviously this has an effect, and we tend to sort of speed eat when we're eating on the go, and we're not really paying attention, so we're distracted when we're eating in front of computers, and this tends to mean we don't chew as well, we eat more quickly, and all of these habits can affect how well we digest food. If you think about the fact that digestion starts off in the mouth with those enzymes in your saliva and the mechanical digestion, and certainly when you eat food and food lands in your stomach, there's the release of hormones which will then communicate up to your brain when you've had enough food. So sometimes if you're eating really, really quickly, you finish your meal before these hormones have had a chance to sort of communicate from stomach to brain. And that's where you can finish a meal, look down, it's all gone, and you still feel hungry. And actually 10 minutes later, you might actually find that your satiety mechanisms catch up.
Yeah, amazing. And just looking over these questions and looking at the questions I wanted to go through that I am deviating from right now, I think our German doctor friend has got quite a good podcast lineup here. So if it's okay with you, let's go through each of these. So I think that's a pretty good overview of digestion. And point number two was the regularity of passing a stool. Can you explain that? Look, what is regular? Is there a regular for a normal person?
Yeah, so in the medical community, or what we consider normal, is that you would poo anywhere from 3 times a day to 3 times a week. And I normally let that land, because then everyone sort of mentally digests that. So yeah, so what's considered normal here, and if we're sort of assessing someone's poo habits, is pooing anywhere from 3 times a day to 3 times a week. And if you're pooing more than that, so you're having more than 3 poos a day, or if you're basically pooing less than every other day, that's what we would consider outside of normal. So if you're having very frequent poos, say 4 poos upwards a day, that would normally indicate your gut motility, so the movement of your gut is very fast, food is not staying inside that long, and it's a very rapid transit through your gut, and on the other end of the scale, if you're pooing less than every other day, it would suggest to us that the gut motility is quite slow, and then sort of waste products are spending quite a lot of time in your large intestine or your colon. And as well as talking about frequency, we also need to talk about what your poo looks like. So sorry for anyone that is finding this a little bit embarrassing, but I'm very used to talking about this now, and I think it's really important, because when we think about assessing gut health, there's lots of things that we can't look at as, you know, general population or taking care of our own health, because our microbiome is inside, it's invisible. Our gut resides inside, we can't see what it looks like. And so the only things that we can really take notice of are how often we're pooing, what it looks like, and also any gut symptoms that we're experiencing. So as well as how often we're going for a poo, we need to have a quick look in the pan and see what it looks like. Are you familiar with something called the Bristol stool chart?
Yes, I was too familiar with that when I was a student.
Okay, good. So you do. So it actually came from Bristol, where I now live, from the BRI here, the Bristol Royal Infirmary. So the Bristol stool chart, for anybody that doesn't know, if you just Google it, you'll find it easily. It's basically a cartoon drawing, seven cartoon drawings of different types of stools from 1 to 7. So types 1 and 2 are sort of hard pellety stools, and these are quite dry stools, hard to pass, and they're normally indicative of a constipated type pattern of pooing. And then at the other end of the scale, so types 6 and 7 are sort of, most of us would sort of term diarrhea. I'm sure we've all had that at some point in our life. Usually you might get it if you've had food poisoning. It can also be a symptom of conditions like IBS or lactose intolerance. And if we're talking about the ideal poo, so it's sort of types 3 to 4. So basically a smooth kind of sausage shape, not painful to pass. You can go for a poo quite easily. It's not causing you any problems. And that's what we would term as normal.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, it's funny when I talk to some of my friends or colleagues about what I remember most about being a student, it was actually walking around on my clinical rotation on the gastro ward with the poo chart and doing that for half my day and talking to patients about that. So that's quite funny you bring it up. Now, this next point, I think this is something that a lot of listeners will probably have experience with. And like you said, it's probably one of the most common things people come to, is the bloating, you know, and these other symptoms, these GI symptoms, and the fact that they shouldn't be happening all the time. Can you talk about what these symptoms are and why they're happening and why it is important to be on top of them?
Yeah, so gut symptoms, there's a lot of them, but to sort of talk about the most common ones, so acid reflux, or this can sort of appear as heartburn. So this is when acid from your stomach can escape back, roll back into your food pipe, and it causes a burning sensation in your chest. Then obviously you've got things like nausea or feeling sick or being sick. And then as we move through the digestive tract, so bloating, and then some people also get distension with bloating. So bloating, just sort of the feeling of being gassy, I guess, and maybe farting a bit more. And distension is where there's sort of this notable change in sort of abdominal girth. And constipation, obviously, we just touched on that briefly. So constipation or diarrhea, but also, I guess, say more problems with pooping. So as I said, if you basically, when you want to go for a poo, you should have to go into the loo and have a poo easily, without sort of spending too long in there. Obviously, if you're reading a magazine to escape from the kids, that's fine. But really, you don't want to be sort of going in and having to sit on the toilet for sort of 10 to 15 minutes just to have a poo. And equally, you don't want to be experiencing pain, and you don't want to be having to strain to have a poo either. And what I will caveat all this with is that it's normal to have occasional gut symptoms. So to give you a couple of examples, there's certain foods which, when you consume them, they're more gas producing, so they contain various sugars or fibers which your gut microbes like to consume, and they produce gases as a result. So beans being one of them, or pulses, so something like hummus. So if I eat a big tub of hummus, I overdo the hummus, I do feel bloated. You know, that's a completely kind of normal physiological response to eating that food. And equally, if you were to go out for a meal once lockdown is over and you've gone out for a meal late at night and had a few drinks and then you've gone to bed, it would be really normal to experience heartburn. Your stomach's full, you're laying back, and there's quite a lot of pressure on your stomach, and it would be quite normal for some acid to escape back up into your food pipe and for you to experience heartburn. So occasionally having symptoms is really normal. And again, you're not going to have the same type of poo every day. If you've been out on the beers, I don't know, that's an expression that you would use there, but you can have something called which is nicknamed the dads or the day after drinking stools. So alcohol can increase gut motility. So you might find that you have loose poos after having, you know, a few too many drinks. And again, that's kind of normal and explainable. But when we're talking about ongoing symptoms, we're talking about symptoms that are bothering you every day, that are affecting your quality of life, and that are really bothersome. And if you are having ongoing symptoms, or if you notice a change in your poo habit, so you used to poo, I don't know, you did used to poo once a day, and now you're finding that you're becoming constipated, or equally that you're pooing a lot more regularly and you're finding that you're going 2 to 3 times a day, that's something to notice, and that's when you would need to chat to your GP or doctor. So occasional symptoms, not problematic, but if you've had a change in your poo that's gone on for longer than a couple of weeks, or you've got these ongoing gut symptoms, it's definitely time to chat to your doctor.
Hey guys, I just quickly want to give a shout out to the team over at Macro Mike. Only because snacking is my favorite thing to do in this life, and Macro Mike has changed the game when it comes to healthy snacks. What they do is use clean and healthy plant-based ingredients, and they make healthy versions of all of those things that you thought you weren't supposed to eat. They make peanut butter and mixes for cookies, brownies, and donuts that you can whip up in literally minutes. And best of all, these are all completely clean and taste beyond phenomenal. They also make protein supplements, protein bars, plant-based aminos, and a great product for your gut health called the Gut Doctor. The flavors that these guys have are seriously insane. Some of my favorites are chocolate hazelnut, Hawaiian salted vanilla, and strawberry jam donut. For a self-confessed snacker, these are a lifesaver. They've been nice enough to give my listeners 10% with the code TFD10, so you guys can try them for yourself. Alrighty, back to the show. Absolutely. So just keeping an eye out for what is normal and if anything deviates from that normal for you. Now, this next point, Laura, is probably something that we'll spend a bit of time discussing. And again, it's one of those terms that gets thrown around a lot that when people may not have a really good understanding of it is. Can you kind of talk us through what the microbiome is and then maybe what is meant by having an unstable microbiome?
Yeah, of course. First of all, microbes, which include bacteria, yeast, and fungi, are everywhere, and they cover all of your body's surfaces, but they also live inside your body too. But inside your body, the majority of microbes are found living in your gut, or specifically your large intestine, because that's a really nice environment for them to live. It's the right sort of conditions. And so I think it's estimated that there's about 39 trillion microbes living in the digestive tract, which is about close to the number of human cells. So we're pretty much like 50% microbe and 50% human. And collectively, these microbes weigh about a kilo, so about the same as a bag of sugar. And so the majority of them, as I said, are living in your large intestine. So the gut microbiome is the genetic material of all the microbes that live in your gut. Okay, so when you read, I guess, I would say popular press or magazines, the word gets interchanged, because the word microbiome is usually referred to just as the microbes. So all these sort of tiny living organisms that live in your gut. But sort of scientifically speaking, the microbiome is actually the genetic catalogue of all these microbes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Something that just pops into my mind when I'm thinking, when you're talking about these huge astronomical numbers, and 39 trillion is a huge number, and I'm thinking of things like probiotics that you give that you can often take, like off-the-shelf probiotics, or that have, say, 1 billion, you know, units or whatever. Are these effective at, you know, affecting the microbiome, so to speak, if it is so large and vast and there's so many? It almost seems like taking a billion, you know, may just be a drop in the ocean compared to the 39 trillion.
Yeah, I probiotics is a really complex area. I think, first of all, it's important to define what a probiotic is. So in order for something to be called probiotic, it has to, it's sort of, there's three parts to it. So a probiotic is live microbes, which when delivered in adequate amounts, will provide a benefit to the person taking them. So they need to be live, they need to get to the gut in sufficient quantities, and they need to do something positive when they get there. And the problem is that a lot of over the off-the-shelf products, I would say, would struggle to meet those criteria. And you know, we touched on the fact that your gut is essentially is the length of a bus. And, you know, in order for a probiotic to actually even get to your gut, it has to go through a lengthy journey. It has to survive the very harsh conditions of the stomach acid. You know, it has to survive getting through the length of the small intestine. And if, you know, the microbes do make it to the large intestine or the colon, maybe there might not be enough to affect a change. So you might have started off with a billion, you might only end up with, you know, 10 to 20% of that amount. And at that level, yes, probably you would, you know, struggle to see any benefits. Probiotics are don't necessarily land in your gut and stay there either. They're transient. So some of the effects might happen as they move through the gut. Some of the effects might happen as they interact with other microbes that are already there. And I don't want to be down on probiotics because there is, you know, some fascinating research. But I guess the point to make is that not all probiotics are the same. And something that's really interesting is that in the UK, our, at least at the moment, until I'm not going to talk about us leaving the EU, but at the moment we're still under EU regulations for food labelling, and this covers supplements as well. And we are regulated by a body called EFSA, which is the European Food Safety Authority. I hope I've said that right. And if somebody wants to put a claim on a food, they have to basically submit their evidence to EFSA to get it approved. Now, so far in the UK, there's been, or just in Europe, there's been over 400 claims submitted for probiotics, and not one of them have been approved. So this means in the UK currently, no one's allowed to make any claims about probiotics. And that's really interesting because when I came to Australia, one of the things that I noticed is that a lot of foods carry the word probiotic, which is something we just don't see here because it's against, you're not allowed to, it's against regulations. And this might seem that, you know, probiotics therefore a bit hopeless, but I think the issue is that the reason we're seeing or we're not seeing the results that we would sometimes want to or expect to in studies is because not all probiotics are the same. They're not all created equal. And what's really important is the viability of them. So the way they're produced commercially. I spoke to a pharmacist quite recently on my podcast about probiotics, and his research is into probiotics and the health effects, and it's his opinion that liquid probiotics are more viable than sort of freeze-dried or dried sort of probiotics which would come in capsule form, and he was sort of very much making the point that, you know, the reason a lot of these studies haven't shown any effect is because the microbes aren't actually getting to the gut in live quantities or in live amounts that would be enough to have an effect.
Wow, that's amazing. And can we kind of skip back a step, Laura? And I guess you can't really talk about probiotics without mentioning prebiotics. And can you explain what the difference between the two is?
So as I said, a probiotic is so live microbes that will deliver a health benefit if they reach your gut in large enough quantities. And prebiotics are effectively food for your microbes. So prebiotics are essentially sort of... broadly speaking, they're a type of fiber, and they specifically feed the beneficial microbes in the gut. So whereas generally dietary fiber sort of feeds all microbes, prebiotics specifically feed beneficial strains. So I was trying to think of a good analogy for this the other day when I was talking to somebody else, and I was saying that, you know, eating fiber, so when fiber reaches your gut, one of the benefits of eating fiber is that it feeds the microbes that live in your gut. So you could think of fiber as watering your lawn, but there potentially are some weeds in your lawn, so you are potentially feeding those as well. But if you take a prebiotic would be, for example, just feeding the roses, for example, so you're just feeding the good bits. If that makes sense. So yeah, we have prebiotics are in, you know, found across a wide sort of range of plant foods. So particularly sort of some vegetables like onion, garlic, artichoke, also some fruits like greenish bananas, sort of testing now to bring these off the top of my head, but they're in a wide range of foods. And here you can also sort of take them as supplements as well. I sort of say to people, you know, there's enough to worry about in our diets already. My sort of personal opinion is that for somebody sort of without any existing gut conditions, if you're eating plenty of fiber and sort of plenty of different types of plant foods as well, you're probably getting a relatively good intake of prebiotics.
Excellent. I guess that's a good little segue as well, Laura. And let me know, I really, really am interested to hear what you think about it. Is there some type of dietary habits or is there some type of diet that you can eat that can, say, stabilize this microbiome or optimize this microbiome, or is it all very individual, or what are your thoughts on it?
So there are some general dietary habits that we can talk about in relation to gut health based on the science and the information that we have. And the first one is fiber. So fiber is a type of carbohydrate that we don't fully digest. So found in plant foods, so fruits and vegetables, whole grain cereals, nuts, seeds, pulses, so beans, peas and lentils. Most of us I think of fiber as, like, I don't know, bran flakes or something similar. But essentially, when we eat fiber, it moves through our digestive tract relatively unchanged, and it lands in the large intestine. And the reason that happens is because humans don't possess the enzymes to break fiber down. So it just kind of moves through your gut, helps with gut motility and sweeps waste through your gut, and then it lands in the large intestine. Now, you remember, as I said, you've got all those microbes that live there. They do actually possess the enzymes to break fiber down. So they break fiber down. And when they do, they produce various kind of compounds known as short-chain fatty acids. And these have beneficial effects throughout the body. They help to keep the lining of the gut healthy, and they have anti-inflammatory effects too. So eating fiber is important for a couple of reasons. So one, it may help to prevent constipation. Secondly, it feeds the microbes in your gut. And thirdly, it may have this sort of whole body effect, as we're talking about, thanks to the metabolites of the microbes. In terms of how much fiber you should be eating, I don't, from what I've seen anyway, we don't have research to say what the optimal amount is for gut health. In the UK, I'm not sure you have to tell me what it is in Australia, but in the UK, it's recommended that people aim to have 30 grams of fiber a day. And I think our average intakes here are something like 18 or 19 grams. So we still have a way to go even to get to that 30 grams. And this 30 gram target was in the UK anyway, came out of from a scientific group called SACAM, which is the Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition. Effectively, they're an independent group of experts that advise the government. And so they, a few years ago, looked at all of the research to do with carbohydrates and health and decided that as a population, we could benefit from increasing our fiber intake. This actually wasn't related to gut microbiome health. It was related to the fact that high fiber diets are associated with a lower risk of bowel cancer, heart disease and type 2 diabetes. But obviously, as over the last few years, as research has come out to suggest that fiber is a good thing for our gut microbiome, it sort of actually chimes quite nicely with that as well.
Brilliant. Excellent. I think that's a very good overview of it. And I think let's move on to this last point, because there's a couple other things I want to touch on afterwards. But I think this is phenomenally interesting, this gut-brain axis. Can you talk about what that is and how our food affects it?
Yeah. So your brain in your head is connected with another brain, which is in your gut. And this is known as the enteric nervous system. So you've got, I don't know how many thousands, but you've got thousands of nerve endings in your gut. So essentially your brain and your gut are connected, and they're connected via a few pathways. So they are physically connected. So there is a long nerve which runs from your brain right into the depths of your gut. This is called the vagus nerve, comes from the Latin name for wandering, which is a really good description for it. If you look at a picture of the vagus nerve online, it looks like it's sort of a long nerve which then spiders outwards and just wanders through the gut. So they're physically connected. And then they are also connected via your microbes. So I said that the microbes in your gut produce various compounds, and some of these compounds are able to travel up and communicate to the brain through the vagus nerve. And thirdly, hormones and messages which come from the brain can travel down into the gut and have various effects. So I think the most obvious way of describing how our gut and brain are connected on a sort of population level is to think about a time when you've been nervous or been anxious about something and you've had to run to the loo.
Yeah.
So this might be in an exam situation, it might be if you're going on a first date, might be you've got a meeting with your boss, or particularly maybe for the population that are listening, maybe on race day, for example, you're quite anxious, you're on high alert, and effectively you might find that you need to rush to the loo. So this would vary, and we also talk about things like gut feelings and, you know, butterflies in our stomach. And this probably on a very sort of basic level is a good example of how our brain and gut are connected. And essentially, whatever you feel mentally, your gut feels it too. So when you feel stressed or when you experience a stressful situation, your HPA axis is activated and cortisol is released. Now, cortisol can actually travel into the gut and affect digestive function. So it can basically put digestion on hold from your stomach. It can actually increase motility in the lower part of your gut. So that's when you need to rush to the toilet. And essentially, all the blood is sort of piling away from your gut and going to the muscles, sort of getting you ready for that fight or flight mode. And, you know, most of the time what causes our stress might be, as I said, a meeting with the boss, you know, financial worries, whatever it is. So we're not actually ready to fight or flight, but our body is still going into that mode. And so on a sort of acute basis, so we might feel stressed and we might think, oh my goodness, I've got tummy cramp, I need to go to the loo, and that might pass relatively quickly. But what I think is more maybe insidious or something sort of to be aware of is that sort of on a long-term basis, studies would suggest that sort of chronic ongoing stress can actually negatively affect the balance of microbes in the large intestine. So it seems like cortisol has a suppressive effect for some of the beneficial microbes. And it's really interesting that in conditions like IBS, which is irritable bowel syndrome, there's a very strong relationship between stress levels and symptom severity. So when people are going through very stressful times, they find that their symptoms are a lot worse. And sometimes actually a stressful event, so going through a divorce or a bereavement, can actually be, for some people, where they can sort of trace the beginnings of their gut symptoms.
Yeah, it's almost mind-boggling, like no pun intended, to think about how much of an effect that, you know, your gut can have on your mind and vice versa. Laura, there's a lot of talk about how much it can contribute to, say, mental health. Can you comment on that? And what's the relationship between, say, your gut and, say, mental health, you know, disorders or your mental health state? Or what are your thoughts on that?
So I think this is an emerging area of research. I'm not the expert, so I'll just kind of maybe give you a couple of top sort of level points, which is that one of the interesting things that we're starting to see is that in certain, I'm calling them disease states, but obviously in this case, mental health sort of conditions. So in people who have depression and anxiety, we can see that they have lower levels of some types of microbes in their gut, which are beneficial. And what we don't know yet, whether this is a cause or consequence of having anxiety or depression. So we know that there is a change in the balance of microbes in the gut. But as I said, we're not sure whether that comes as a, you know, whether it's consequential or whether it might be actually involved in the process of developing depression and anxiety. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that what's really interesting is that we're seeing that the some microbes seem to affect mood and behavior. So this research sort of started out in mice, and what they found, so mice are kind of good candidates for looking at the gut microbiome because essentially they can be born or they can be kept sort of germ-free. So they're born and then they're sort of, they don't have a microbiome, and then you can put specific strains of bacteria in and kind of monitor what happens. And in mice born without a microbiome, scientists noticed that they have an aggravated stress response. So what they kind of concluded from those early studies is that the microbiome is important for regulating stress. And specific microbes might actually play a role in stress regulation. And then going on from there, we're starting to see that particular strains of bacteria can actually influence mood and behavior in positive ways. And these have been dubbed psychobiotics. So I'll link to a book which is actually called Psychobiotics by the two researchers that have sort of seminal researchers in this area, John Crine and Ted Dynan. And yeah, so they sort of identified these microbes that seem to have beneficial effects on mental health. And studies are starting to take place now where different groups that are struggling with depression and anxiety are sort of undergoing interventions where they're given sort of psychobiotics, and actually it's some quite promising research to suggest that it does actually make a difference on mood and behavior.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal, hey, and like you said, it is such an emerging field that I'm sure you could just spend hours and hours and hours searching for information that probably leads you to even more questions that'll lead you to more information that'll lead to more questions, and you just go on and on and on. But just before I let you get on with your day, Laura, I could probably talk to you about this for hours and hours before I let you get on with your day. In terms of an athletic population, how does the gut health affect the athletic population?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think generally speaking, exercise is really positive for the gut. So exercise can influence gut motility. So actually may help to, there's not really strong evidence actually about exercise and constipation, but we know that exercise increases gut motility. So there is a sort of thought process that actually regular exercise, you know, may help to prevent constipation. And secondly, it's not completely clear why, but people who, studies have shown that sort of exercise interventions where you take a sedentary population and you sort of ask them to exercise 3 times a week, whatever that intervention might be, walking, cycling, so moderate exercise for sort of 6 to 8 weeks. What we see is we see a positive shift in the balance of microbes in the gut. So exercise seems to have this positive effect on the gut microbiome, although it's not kind of completely clear why, whether it's something to do with inflammation, whether it's something to do with the increased circulation of bile acids during exercise. It's not clear, but it seems to be positive. So exercise generally is a good thing for gut health. What's interesting is that when we get into populations who are training really hard or intensely, so athletic populations, we see that lots of them actually struggle with gut symptoms. And there was, as an example, there was a study of long distance triathletes who were competing in extreme conditions, and up to 93% of them reported gut symptoms, so things like nausea, cramps and vomiting. And it's been, I mean, I don't work with athletic or sports populations anymore, but when I was working and studying more in sports nutrition, it's definitely something that comes up a lot, which is gut symptoms when training and running. And this is for a number of reasons. So during exercise, blood flow to the gut will reduce, and that's because it's moving towards the working muscles and the skin. And although there are differences between individuals, when you're working really, really high intensity, basically as hard as you can, blood flow to the gut can be reduced by as much as 80%. And so when you think about that, the fact that there's now less blood flow to these sort of to the tissues of the gut, it means that there's going to be less oxygen to the gut, and coupled with the effects of potentially sort of dehydration, or if you're exercising in hot temperatures, this can make the gut particularly vulnerable to damage. And so there's that aspect of it. And at the same time, exercise, as I've talked about already, can cause changes in gut motility. And this can happen either at the upper end or the lower end. So if, for example, like you sort of eaten too close to exercise, I'm sure we've all had the experience of, you know, feeling sort of like you've got heartburn or cramps while you're exercising. And this is because, as I said, the blood flow has moved away from from the gut, so digestion has slowed down. So the rate at which the stomach is emptying will be reduced, and this can trigger sort of feeling sick or acid reflux. And at the other end, a combination of sort of changes in blood flow and the mechanical stimulation of the gut, and maybe sort of excitement or nerves on race days may actually cause people to want to poop when exercising as well. And a particular group that seem to be kind of quite vulnerable are runners. It sounds almost quite amusing, but this is purely because of the high impact of running on the gut. And if you can imagine, if you're running quite intensely at long distance, you've got this sort of prolonged vertical bouncing of the gut. And this means that the gut actually undergoes quite a lot of impact. And this is thought to contribute to some of the symptoms that we see in runners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a phenomenal answer. Very, very informative. Laura, I'm just being conscious of time here, so I won't keep you too much longer. Just one last question. Say if someone was listening and say they're generally healthy, they've got a good diet, no medical conditions or anything, but they just want to make sure that they're doing everything they can to keep their gut as healthy as possible. What are some of the things that you would recommend to them?
I guess we can look at three areas. So the first one being diet. So I talked about fiber intake, so that's really important. Something else that people can focus on if they're already sort of ticking the fiber box is making sure you get lots of variety in your diet. So, and particularly of plant foods. So plant-based eating has become really, really popular in the last few years. But actually some quite interesting research about plant foods and gut health. So plant foods obviously have fiber components, depending on which ones you eat, but they also have various compounds in them known as polyphenols, and these are effectively compounds which sort of help to keep the plant healthy. There are various compounds which we don't digest but actually can help to feed our microbes. So plant foods contain lots of sort of, I guess, nutrients for our gut. And there was a study, I'm trying to think how many years ago it was, few years ago now, as part of the American Gut Project, which was a big citizen science project, which looked for, which was looking at the balance of basically looking at the, trying to map the gut microbiome of, it was mostly American population, but there were also some people that took part in the UK and also Australia. And essentially people had to send off bits of their poo in the paste several times over the space of the study, and also answer really detailed questionnaires about their lifestyle and diet. And then their poo was analysed so they could sort of try and map their microbiome. And researchers then sort of analysed their diets and tried to look for any correlations. And one of the things that came out of this study was that people who regularly ate 30 different types of plant foods a week had a more diverse microbiome than those who ate 10 or fewer. And this is really interesting because it suggests, I mean, as dietitians, we generally do recommend like having a varied diet because different foods contain different nutrients. And obviously that eating a varied diet can ensure that you get all the nutrients you need. And it's pretty similar for your microbes. So your microbes, different nutrients feed different microbes. So eating a wide variety of plant-based foods seems to be helpful. So, you know, taking that into a practical sense. So we tend to all be creatures of habit, but rather than having the same fruits and vegetables every day, trying to mix those up, you know, rather than having the same nuts as a snack, trying to maybe choose mixed ones, using different herbs and spices in your cooking. And maybe if you're somebody that always has, I don't know, whole grain pasta, thinking about having rice, quinoa, other types of grains as well. So trying to kind of circulate the foods that you eat. So that would be sort of my two big things for diet. And then the other two areas that I was going to sort of talk about was exercise and mental health. So on the exercise point, as I said, you know, exercise is a good thing. If you're someone who's sort of in the athletic population, I guess it's just taking care of your gut. So, you know, there's an aspect of, you'll be able to sort of talk much more about this in terms of training your gut. But obviously, you know, if you're an endurance athlete and you do need to take on board fluid and carbohydrate during exercise, you need to train your gut to be able to do that. So practicing nutrition strategies early on into training will help your gut get used to that. Making sure you build in rest periods. So rest does help the body, but also the gut to recover. So I talked about, you know, there can be quite a lot of stress on the gut after a hard, intense training session. So making sure you build in adequate rest periods. And then you may want to, there's a little bit of evidence that, and I know I sort of talked about not all probiotics being the same, but there is some evidence for probiotic sort of supplementation, particularly during kind of intense training periods, which may help to reduce GI symptoms. And also I think sort of during, maybe not so much for you guys in Brisbane, but for anyone that's kind of training sort of during winter or when it's sort of quite cold outside as well, sort of there's a little bit of evidence that taking a probiotic may actually help to reduce the incidence of respiratory sort of symptoms. And the last area is sort of the mental health aspect. So it's a really overlooked one, I think. And you know, I'm glad that the conversation about mental health is becoming more common and more open. But essentially, if something to remember or take away is that, you know, when you feel stressed, your gut feels it too. So learning how to manage stress is really important, both for your mental health, but also for your gut. And what's, I think, really interesting and promising is that for conditions like IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, which affects a lot of the population, we have for a long time focused on dietary adjustments to help with symptoms, and that can be very helpful. But what's emerging from the evidence now is that mind-body interventions, so things like yoga and CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, and breathing, sort of deep breathing exercises and interventions, are actually coming out as being as effective as dietary adjustments for symptom control. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. Especially that last point, right? I remember many, many moons ago, back before I kind of went into my specialty within combat sports and working in a more generalistic sense in a clinic, whenever I had gut health clients, I remember the first three things I always used to say before we used to start any, say, FODMAPs interventions or anything was sleep, stress, and water, and make sure that you've got those three things ticked off. And if we're still not there, then maybe let's look at a dietary approach. But that's phenomenal, Laura. That's a super informative episode. I think I was very hypocritical in saying that I don't particularly enjoy going off script for the podcast, and we just went completely off script, but I think for the better. That was amazing. Laura, you run your own podcast. You've got a really big following over in the UK. You do a lot of writing. People will obviously listen to this, and I encourage them, if they've got any further gut health questions, to reach out to you. What's the best way for them to, one, get onto your podcast, and two, get onto you?
Yeah, sure. So my podcast is called The Gut Loving Podcast. It's available on iTunes and Spotify. And essentially, we talk, the motivation for podcasts came from, you know, sitting in those early days in clinic and sort of seeing people with IBS and sort of being quite frustrated on their behalf that they were being given so much rubbish information. So it's we're on the third series now. The first two series are very much focused on IBS, what it is, symptom management, and you know what you can do to take control of your symptoms. And in this third season, we're sort of branching out a bit more into gut health more generally. So I've interviewed a psychologist about CBT and the effect on the gut. I've interviewed a pharmacist. So that probiotics episode is really interesting. I've interviewed a neurogastroenterologist about the gut-brain axis. So although it is, there's a focus on IBS, it's kind of removing into sort of more general themes that I think anyone might find interesting. And the other place to sort of probably get hold of me, I mean, my website is lauratilt.com, but I'm on Instagram. They say my name is NutriTilty. Basically, it's a combination of nutrition and tilt. My last name, and it's something I don't know. I chose that name many years ago, and it sort of followed me around now. Because my nickname is Tilty for people that know me, so NutriTilty. But I can sort of write that down for you, and maybe we can stick it in the show notes. But I tend to be, I do a bit of posting on there, and particularly doing sort of lockdown. You know, we've done a few lives on you know, gut health topics. I do also have two online courses. So I've got one called the Happy Gut Guide, which is basically a 12-week self-care program for IBS. And again, this was born out of, you know, realizing that not everybody has access to a dietitian. Here you can refer to a dietitian through the GP, but not all areas have dietitians, and also not everyone can afford to see one. So essentially that was me sort of turning what I would do with you in person into online as far as possible. And I've just launched another course called Get Gutsy, which is effectively a no-nonsense guide to just taking care of your gut health for anyone that doesn't have symptoms, but is just interested in the science and how to practically apply some of the things that we've talked about today into your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to repeat them so the people listening at home can get that again, because I could not recommend them higher to do that. So that was the Gut Loving Podcast, yeah. Nutri-Tilty on socials. Then we've got the guide, we've got the Happy Gut Guide, and then we've got Get Gutsy for the courses online. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. That was hugely informative. I got a lot out of that. I'm sure everyone listening at home got a lot out of that. I would love to stay in contact and get you on again. I think we may have found our resident TFD gut health advisor. So I would love to have you back on the show again. But Laura, thank you for taking the time, and I'll stop talking now so you can get on with your day.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Laura. Chat to you soon.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Laura is amazingly informed when it comes to not only identifying what it means to have a healthy gut, but in offering practical solutions to what we can do to achieve that. I highly encourage you to follow her on her socials to stay up to date with everything to do with maintaining a healthy gut. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.